Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sharon Brody, in for Meghna Chakrabarty.
Cheating is a big problem. And just how big is it?
Well, consider this. Research shows that 75% of college students, yes, that's 3 out of 4, admit to cheating.
And those are only the students who admit it.
But there are things we can do to curb cheating, says my guest today, and those efforts do not involve making the penalties any harsher. James Lang is director of the Center for Teaching Excellence at Assumption College and the author of Cheating Lessons, Learning from Academic Dishonesty. He joins me here in the studio. James Lang, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
And listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Did you, do you cheat in school? And why? And what can we all do to stop it? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you'll find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So, James Lang, we are going to dig in here as to why students cheat and what you suggest we can do about it. Let's start off with some of the basics. How prevalent is cheating among college students?
So the first major survey on cheating in the United States was conducted in 1963 by a doctoral student in sociology at Columbia University. He sent out surveys to around 5,000 students in the United States. And the results that he got back, what he did was he sort of had a list of 13 clearly defined cheating behaviors. Mm-hmm. And he asked the survey respondents to let him know whether they had engaged in any of these behaviors during their 4 years in college. And the number he got back was around 75% of students admitted to engaging in at least one of these behaviors. Now, there's two important things about this. First is that you frequently will hear the narrative that cheating has gotten much worse these days, the kids with their crazy technologies and all that stuff. And that really doesn't seem to be the case because the numbers were astronomically high in 1963. The numbers that we see now, it's hard to know exactly. They're a little bit more difficult to pin down because the major cheating researcher in the United States today is a man named Don McCabe, and he's conducted surveys on the web between 2002 and 2010, and those numbers suggest that the numbers are maybe a little bit lower, but those surveys were conducted over the web, and his theory is that the fewer students are willing to acknowledge their cheating mm-hmm. behaviors on the web, maybe because they're afraid that it's going to be tracked back to them in a way that in 1963, when you were sending a letter off to some anonymous right. survey person, you know, you didn't expect that was going to get back to you. So the numbers are high. Now, just one last point about this, which is that the number represents the number of students who say they've cheated at least once in their college career. So that could be that it's a small number of students who are cheating more regularly, mm-hmm. but the number that are doing it at least once is very high.
So who are these students who at least admit to cheating? I mean, rich students, poor students,
yeah.
smart, struggling, first-year seniors. I mean, where are we here?
So actually, the bulk of the research that's been done prior to now has been looking at what they call these demographic or dispositional factors. Mm-hmm. In other words, what features of the student's life situation seem to be inclined to make him cheat more or less. So they do look at things like gender. At one time, it seemed to be that men cheated more than women. I would have found this unsurprising, but that seemed to be the case at one time. Those numbers seem to be actually evening out now. And that may be because there's tends to be higher cheating levels in environments like business, science, and engineering, and more women are entering those fields now, so that's kind of stabilizing the cheating rates in terms of genders. There's all kinds of information about, like I said, other kinds of demographic factors. So, for example, younger students and first-year students cheat more than older students. Or students who are seniors. Students who are in fraternities or sororities do cheat more than students who are not. So we do have all those kinds of demographic factors about who cheats and who doesn't. My concern with that, and the reason I sort of took a different tack with my own research mm-hmm. was because as a faculty member, I can't control that. I can't change a student's gender or, you know, tell them to join or not join a fraternity. So to me, that information is interesting. It can maybe help us think about how to target certain groups of students on campus. But I'm concerned to know, what can I do and why are students cheating in my classes?
Okay, well, let's get to that. What is your prescription for reducing cheating? I mean, I guess you're coming at this as there's no way to stop it altogether, human nature being what it is.
Sort of. I do think that you know, no matter what we do, there's going to be a small number of students who cheat no matter what. And no matter what happens, how you design your classes and the most fascinating class in the world, there's going to be one or two kids who might cheat in it. But my argument actually is that we need to look at the learning environment. And cheating oftentimes is an inappropriate response to a learning environment that's not working for the student. Now, the response is inappropriate, and there's no question about that. We shouldn't excuse it, and we do need to respond to it. But for whatever reason, that learning environment isn't working for that student. It's not motivating that student. It hasn't given the student the tools that he or she needs to succeed. So what I'm trying to suggest is that let's look at the learning environment, and let's see if we can look at the research to find areas or sort of components of that learning environment, classroom design, what the teacher's doing, how the teacher speaks to the students. Are there the things in those areas that actually induce or reduce cheating? And if we can find those, then we can maybe start to key in on some of those areas.
Okay, we'll get to that in 1 second. Listeners, we're talking with James Lang. He's the director of the Center for Teaching Excellence at Assumption College in Worcester, author of Cheating Lessons, Learning from Academic Dishonesty. And we'd like to hear from you, listeners, about cheating and school and the whole shebang. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So, James Lang, this learning environment and how we can adjust that to disincentivize, I guess, an awful word, cheating.
Yeah. The book focuses on a small number. And what I tried to look at in the book were a small number of features of a class. And what I tried to focus on were not just features of the learning environment that would reduce cheating, but also ones that we know from research in learning theory are likely to increase learning. I didn't want to sort of present this research and then have faculty say to me, well, I'm not going to change my classes just to reduce cheating. I want to be able to say, no, you shouldn't do that. You should change these classes in order to increase learning. And the side benefit of that is it's going to reduce cheating.
Wait, though, don't professors give you a little pushback when you are suggesting, hey, here's how you can improve learning?
Well,
I mean, they're professors.
All I'm doing is reporting what the research tells
okay.
us. And people can make their own decisions about how they want to revise their classes or not. I'll give you one example, though, in terms of one of the features of the learning environment. There's two ways that we can think about students or learners having a sort of an orientation toward the class. And one is a performance orientation and one is a mastery orientation. Now, students who have a performance orientation are interested in doing well on the tests, getting good grades on the papers. Students who have a mastery orientation are interested in gaining mastery of the material. They are interested. They want to understand it. They want to be able to use it. They see it as relevant to their lives somehow. Well, it turns out that classes that have a strong performance orientation have more cheating. That's mm-hmm. kind of an intuitive, unsurprising conclusion in some ways, right? If you're putting all the pressure of the class onto ensuring, telling the students you really want them to do well on the tests, they're more likely to do dishonest things in order to do well on those tests. So that means then as teachers, we need to think about how do we create that master orientation. And it turns out we do know from research and learning theory that mastery orientation leads to deeper learning. So this is one of these kind of key areas where if we can put the emphasis on mastery over performance, we know that it's going to increase learning, and we also know that it's going to reduce cheating.
Okay, let's take a call. Tom from Brookline is calling. Tom, hello, you're on Radio Boston.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. So what's your thought here?
Well, you know, I have a take on this that you know, it might be a little bit unconventional. I actually operate a small business that assists college students in cheating with their math homework. I want to stress from the outset that I do not help people who are going to eventually be in charge of erecting bridges or, you know, building planes or anything. I focus on people who are doing business, non-technical majors, things like that. I specifically weed out people who will eventually have any kind of responsibility for public welfare. But the reason I do what I do is that, having studied math myself, I appreciate it as an art and I appreciate it as an intellectual discipline. I think that people are being held responsible for knowledge that ultimately is not relevant to their course of study, not relevant to their chosen line of work, and I think that it's unreasonable that somebody would be held back from getting a business degree or, you know, an English degree, a criminal justice degree, because they can't do algebra or calculus.
Okay, thanks, Tom. Well, James, I mean, one workaround for that, it sort of seems instead of helping people cheat on their math homework, perhaps just actually helping them with their math and then working on the outside to change the system where maybe we don't require such extensive math of people who won't be engineers. I don't know. What do you think, James?
Well, the caller's making a good point in the sense that one of the other reasons that we see cheating is motivation. And so if the learner doesn't see the course material as relevant for their lives or as intriguing or fascinating, as the caller just said, he finds math intriguing, fascinating as an art form. And so as a result, he's motivated to learn math for its own sake. Well, one of the other features of the book is extrinsic versus intrinsic motivation. So extrinsic motivation means you're doing it because you need the grade. You have to pass the class in order to get your degree. Intrinsic motivation means that you are fascinated by it. You see it as relevant to your life. You're doing it because you love the discipline or the subject matter or whatever. So again, the same sort of pairing meets up here. We know that students who are extrinsically motivated cheat more, and we also know that they have shallower levels of learning. They tend to learn and then forget very easily. So the issue here is then, can we find ways to draw out intrinsic or foster intrinsic motivation in students in subjects that we're asking them to take that they might not initially have an interest in? And again, that's something that I think we have to work on in terms of how we design courses.
Okay, so let's get to that. What do you suggest in terms of specifics for designing classes, and how do you do that without increasing cost and work levels for the professors?
So the argument that I make here is that there are two ways to think about a college course. The one is on what we call the coverage model, in which I come in and say, I'm going to cover this material from point A to point Z, and I'm going to present it to you, and you should learn it because it's valuable, and I'm going to test you on it. Right. So I might come into an economics class and say, you know, there's 10 introductory principles here that you're going to learn. I'm going to teach you about the history of economics. And at the end, you'll know more about economics. That's the coverage model. The model that I'm arguing is more likely to foster intrinsic motivation is a course design based on a problem, question, or challenge. We tend to be interested in questions and problems and things that might challenge us. So, for example, in an economics course, instead, this was an example was given to me by a colleague, I might come into the class and say, you know, how many of you like to download music and you do it for free and you think that that's something you should be able to do? And they might say, oh, yeah, I do that. That's great. I should be able to get me on music for free. Okay, well, then how do you think the musicians should get compensated for making that music? Oh, okay, I see that. So there has to be some sort of regulation in terms of ensuring that musicians get paid. Okay, so now we're talking about a free market economy that has some regulations in it. All right, well, let's think about this a little further. And you kind of pose that question or problem to them, and then believe me, that one example will take you through every principle of economics if you look at, you know, the music industry, the way it's changed over the last 10 years. So my argument is that we need to think about classes that get at questions that students already find interesting or that we can make them interesting to the students by connecting them to things that matter to them and by showing them how our class material can be relevant to their lives. I had an ancient history course, you know, in college that I cannot remember a single thing from, right? And it was presented to me as a coverage. Here's ancient history, Greeks and Romans, and but there was no effort to sort of help me make that relevant to my life.
Okay, well, wouldn't some also argue that it's sort of the student's job? The student takes out of a educational, out of a course, what the student puts into it, that it's not up to the professor or the university to spoon feed and make it fun and make it relevant. It's the student's job to do that for themselves. And it's also the student's job not to cheat.
It's the student's job to learn the material. But again, we just know from this research on learning theory that if the student doesn't see it as somehow relevant to their own life, they're going to learn it in much shallower ways. So they'll learn it for the test, and they might be able to get an A on that final exam. But 3 months later, they're not going to remember a thing from that class if they don't see it as relevant to their life somehow. So some students might have the ability to do that, but not all of them do. And so what I'm arguing is that we need to give them a little bit more help in showing them how does this course material impact your life in some way. And that's, again, learning theorists tell us that this is kind of how our brains evolved, to be able to keep an information that matters to us, right, that's personally relevant to our survival or to our happiness, right? And things that aren't, we kind of discard. We forget and let go. So if we want our material to stick with students, we have to help them see how it's relevant to their lives.
Okay. Let's take a call now from Chris. Chris is calling from Brewster. Hey, Chris.
Hi, good afternoon. I guess I have one question about the research, and that is that there are institutions that are legendary for having a very prominent and very strict honor code. And the question is whether the research would suggest that that makes any difference. I understand that's a tough question to answer because there are going to be some selection effects in terms of who chooses to go to those institutions, but I'm just curious if there's been any research into that, and I'll go ahead and take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Chris. That's a great question. I'm curious about that, too, the effect of the honor code on the cheating story.
It's actually an easy question to answer. Honor codes do reduce, in schools which have honor codes, traditional honor codes, cheating rates are lower. Now, there's a however here. I think that the reason that that happens is because the honor code gives the institution an opportunity to talk about cheating with its students. And okay. So it gives some sort of frequent reminders about the fact that, you know, we don't cheat on this campus. I actually don't think an honor code is necessary for that. So a lot of times in the wake of a cheating scandal, you'll see institutions sort of jumping to formulate an honor code, which is a long and difficult process. And I think there are some problematic features of a traditional honor code, like asking students to report on one another. And I would argue that what the campus really needs is just a robust conversation about cheating, and that's the reason that we see lower cheating rates at honor code institutions.
Okay. Now, part of your recommendations for this, designing courses in which students answer questions, solve problems, meet challenges. You also say that we need more frequent and less high stakes assessments. Let's tackle that angle of your recommendation.
So the basic argument here is that if you're constructing a course which has a midterm and a final only, right, you're giving students two opportunities to earn their grade in the class. So you're putting a tremendous amount of pressure on each of those two opportunities. If you have a class in which students have multiple chances over the course of the semester to earn their grade, you're reducing the pressure on it as long as you keep the stakes for cheating consistent. So that the response to a cheating student is going to be the same at even the lower or higher stakes, well, then the gain is reduced for each of those assignments, and the stakes remain high for each one. So that's why I argue that what we should try to be doing is giving more frequent assessments, more opportunities for students to demonstrate their learning. And once again here, this is one of these other sort of pairings, is we definitely know from learning theory, the more chances students have to demonstrate their learning to us, the more deeply they learn it. So there's a well-known phenomenon called the testing effect, which tells us that actually we tend to think about tests as measuring learning. Testing actually is one of the best ways for people to learn.
The
test itself helps people to learn. So that doesn't just apply to tests. It can apply to anything that you ask students to do, which requires them to retrieve material from their memory and sort of rehearse it in front of or for an evaluator. And anytime they do that, you're actually learning much more effectively than when you just stare at your notes, for example. So an instructor can really help students by giving them lots of opportunities to demonstrate their learning, and also spreading it across different environments. So some is writing, some is presentation, some is tests, quizzes, exams, all that kind of stuff. The more of that you do, actually, the more you're going to help your students learn, and the lower stakes, you're driving down the stakes on each of those assessments.
You know, it's interesting because we're talking about college students, but it occurs to me that, in the early grades of education in the U.S., for the most part, teachers tend to encourage students, there's no dumb questions, mistakes are how you learn, fail better, that whole sort of mantra. And then, of course, over time, that approach pretty much goes by the wayside. In college, as you point out, a lot of times one or two exams determines your whole grade, and there's no option to learn through exploration and trial and error. And it just sort of sounds like you're suggesting creating learning environments in college that would reduce cheating and improve learning, that we kind of get a philosophy going that would be very familiar to a lot of six-year-olds.
It would be, actually. And I mean, I think we have a lot to learn, actually, college faculty do, from looking at what goes on in elementary. My wife is a kindergarten teacher, and every once in a while I'll come home, I'll read some, book about a new teaching technique, and I'll come home and say, Anne, you don't believe this incredible thing I'm going to try in my classroom. She's like, I've been doing that for like 8 years, And so I do think we have a lot to learn because, for one thing, most of us who teach college never had any kind of class in how to teach. We weren't educated. We were educated in our disciplines, but we're not educated in education. Right. And most high school and elementary school teachers are. And just to add one last thing, because what you were saying earlier is about how we encourage students. And another one of these features that tends to increase cheating is when students have low self-efficacy. So if they believe they're incapable of succeeding on the exam, they're more likely to cheat on it. And that just kind of makes sense again. But what that tells us is if we come into a class and say, this is a very difficult exam, very few of you are going to get A's on it, well, you're giving them a kind of talk that's designed to increase cheating.
Interesting. Let's take another call here. I'd like to hear from Ian from Newburyport. Ian, hi. You're on Radio Boston.
Yeah, hello. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. As a segue into your last comment, it's an interesting segue into why I'm calling, which is when I began my college career, I did cheat on a few occasions on a test, and though I wasn't conscious of it at the time, in hindsight, I realized that I felt like I didn't belong in college. I felt like I wasn't smart enough or good enough to be there. The way I was raised by my parents, who were very blue collar, I'm one of five kids. I'm the only one that went to college, and I guess I had been raised to believe that I don't really measure up, you know, from an intelligence perspective, and that because I'm their offspring, you know, I'm not going to amount to much, and so I had a very low sense of self-worth there, and I'm looking around in this classroom and I'm listening to some of these questions being asked and I'm thinking, you know, I felt like an imposter there.
So, and you feel that led you down the path to cheating?
Yeah, it did. I felt like this is what I needed to do to feel like okay about my presence there, because I just, you know, because I felt like an imposter, and it was so deeply ingrained in my being, having been raised the way I was, and I wanted to do well, I wanted to amount to something, but I just felt like it was unreachable for me, and unless I, you know, did it falsely.
Right, right. Well, Ian, thank you so much for calling in. James, do you see a lot of that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, this is one of the major factors. And again, this is a very intuitive kind of thing. You know, if someone doesn't believe they're capable of succeeding on the exam, the only option they really have is to do it in a dishonest way. The trick here is to give students early success opportunities, right? So early in the semester, you need to be able to show them that they're capable of doing the material. Again, think about how many, and I wonder how many callers out there have said in their lives, I can't do math, right? Now, put a student like that in a math class, and what's going to happen, right? They believe they can't do math, and that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so then maybe they see their only option as doing things dishonestly. So that's another reason why we also don't want those infrequent assessments. If a student goes 8 weeks throughout the semester thinking these things, once they get to that eight-week mark and it's the midterm exam, they're more likely to be dishonest. But if in the first, second, third week they've had chances to do something and they are able to see, yeah, I didn't do it perfectly, but I'm capable of doing this, then that's going to give them that sense of self-efficacy they need in order to do their work honestly.
Right. Well, James Lang, this has been an intriguing discussion, and we thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
James Lang is director of the Center for Teaching Excellence at Assumption College. He's the author of Cheating Lessons, Learning from Academic Dishonesty. Stay with us. Coming up, singer-songwriter Patty Larkin performs live in our studio. I'm Sharon Brody with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.